Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for November 1st, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast, and in it, an open protocol for aggregating online comments. The first open source voting system is released from a vendor as opposed to from academia. Exploiting Unix and Linux through the LDD command. And Lord Mandelson still pushing through a three strikes rule in the UK. All of this and more. First, though, I wanted to explain the bed music. This is just an experiment just for today. It's track 24 from Nine Inch Nails' Ghosts 1 through 4 album. It's actually a two-disc album, a four-volume album, obviously from the name. I just kind of felt like changing things up a little bit today, and I've been meaning to actually give this a play because there's a couple of other tracks I might play just for the intro to kind of see how they fit and feel. I'm curious if you have any feedback, whether you like it or you hate it. Doesn't matter. Let me know. I also need to let you know that this track is used under permissions of a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license, which is entirely compatible with my license. So when we get to the outro bumper at the end where I mention about the recycling of bits from this program, this is going to be an exception. I don't have the rights to this, but it is, as I said, used under a compatible license. You can send whatever thoughts you have on this experimental intro music to feedback at thecommandline.net. You can post a comment up on the website, or you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If a lot of you like this, or at least like the idea of maybe highlighting some open content music out there that's worth calling attention to, then perhaps I'll continue, perhaps with the same track or experimenting with others. If you don't like it, don't worry about it. Not a big deal. Like I said, it's just an experiment to try something out a little bit different, see how it goes. And if nobody but me likes it, then we'll go ahead and return back to the usual intro music that everybody's accustomed to next time. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. This first alert is a story about how a utility that probably not many of us are too terribly familiar with, and maybe the rest of us take for granted, actually can be used to exploit a Unix-based or Linux or BSD system. That's the LDD or List Dynamic Dependencies utility. It's useful for determining which libraries a program loads. So you give it as an argument a binary file, and it'll actually figure out what shared object files, what shared library files that program actually relies upon. In particular, it's good for figuring out the specific version and the exact file if you've got multiple versions, as many Linux systems in particular often will. This will help narrow it down. It's useful for system administrators trying to sort out a library dependency issue in order to get something installed, configured, up and running, but also for programmers trying to debug differences introduced through different library versions. The article here, an exploratory blog post, demonstrates running LDD and discusses a bit how it actually works under the covers if you weren't already familiar, like I wasn't. Like I said, I just took for granted that this does what it does without giving it too much thought about how it actually does it. In particular, he points out how you can actually make LDD vulnerable or a venue for exploit by utilizing a custom loader just through a standard attribute of the binary executable formats that are used on the affected systems. If an app actually specifies one, LDD will actually run that rather than the stock one on the system. And that's where the risk comes in, that an attacker could potentially socially engineer a system administrator, someone who has much greater privilege on a box than they do, by tricking them into using LDD for its intended purpose to suss out a dependency problem. And the post here actually describes a very plausible scenario, an interchange over the phone or through IM to do just that. And it seems pretty benign on the surface until you realize that this could be done in order to execute by coincidence a malicious loader that the attacker, also undertaking this social engineering attack, could place alongside their program to be executed by LDD with that administrator's privileges. In that way, tricking someone into executing that custom code through LDD is just as bad as getting them to, through whatever other more traditional means, execute a malicious program directly. If the attack code is actually very well written, they may not even realize what has happened. The risk here, obviously, to end users is somewhat small. I mean, they have to know what LDD is, they have to be in the habit of using it, and doing so with a privileged account. This really is, I think, more of a cautionary tale for administrators to never run LDD, exactly as this post says, on an executable that is unknown to you. And it's kind of an academic example, but it does remind us that it is useful to understand how our actual utilities work, so that we also understand the potential risks when we're using them. The other alert I have is one that's been, some of the reporting around this is a bit inflammatory and inciting. And this is a story about a former antivirus researcher kind of turning against the industry. And I've linked to the discussion of this by Brian Krebs at the Washington Post in his Security Fix blog. And he digs into this a little bit more, and what it ultimately sounds like is the fellow in question was someone playing maybe a bit too fast and too loose with the rules. He does mention a bootkit presentation. This is similar to these cold boot attacks that I've been talking about, both the one that was demonstrated by researchers at Princeton, the more recent one, the Evil Maid attack demonstrated by Joanna Bratkowska, falls into this category of attacks that take place before the bootloader spins up and actually loads the operating system. And this really seems to have been the start of the trouble for the individual in question, Peter Kleissner. There's some other incidents talked about in Krebs's article that even he gives a sense that these are not entirely confirmed, or they're at least harder to confirm, such as the fact that Kleissner supposedly cracked an internet kiosk on his way home from the Black Hat conference. Krebs actually corresponded with Kleissner to try to get to the bottom of some of this, and not surprisingly, he rebutted some of the claims, like he has that claim that he has turned to the side of attackers with this latest project, AV Tracker. This is a service that tracks the addresses of distributed malware scanners that researchers and defenders use to help identify and spread information to other researchers and white hats to deal with newly identified malware. So not everybody has to have dedicated networks to find these things. This AV Tracker that Kleissner put out could be used by malware authors to make their software more aware of when they're being downloaded, even just downloaded, but also examined by such defensive tools. He claims a comment in particular in the tools, either in his documentation or the source code, that others have been pointing to that made it seem like he was cooperating with a known malware gang, actually was nothing more than an Easter egg, kind of thumbing his nose at the establishment. It's really kind of hard to know what is really going on here, especially if he's kind of willfully entertaining these sorts of jokes that I think are kind of in poor taste given the risks involved to end users and to industry. Since he was ostracized by the research community after Black Hat, including ultimately being let go, again, the presumption is because of the heat he drew for that bootkit presentation, although that's an inference at best, I think. He is young, and the impression I get is he's quite brash, so this may just be the nature of being young and thinking you're smarter than everybody else, which may be justifiable, maybe not. But the sense that I get is that this maybe is more of a personality issue, an ad hominem sort of circumstance, that he's really kind of mostly harmless, but the industry doesn't like how he is actually representing them, that when he was actually employed by a legitimate researcher, that it understandable some people could feel he's painting security researchers as a whole in kind of an unflattering light. Krebs cites many in the industry who are actually ultimately very unconcerned by his AV Tracker project. Many malware authors have already done something quite similar to what this does. The one holdout to that was really more concerned about kind of the potential, a trend that could evolve out of this, either prompted by AV Tracker specifically or just growing out of this current kind of shared practice amongst a lot of malware. That is, that malware authors might start to get a little bit more coordinated around these sorts of efforts and hence raise the cost of defense for everybody. Here are the news that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website, thecommandline.net. Ryan Paul at Ars Technica had a very thoughtful piece this past week on a couple of different discussions around the search for a truly open or free smartphone, free as in the sense of software freedom. He's actually put together a pretty good representative survey of the issue and ties in, as I said, commentaries from Harold Welt, formerly of OpenMoco, and SFLC's own Bradley Kuhn. The discussion was partly spurred, actually, by a story that I've talked about in the past, Symbian releasing its kernel sources under the Eclipse public license. Welt, in particular, is very skeptical of this based on his experience from OpenMoco, and the cost to develop a phone is huge, and doing so with an open-source project, he thinks ultimately is not entirely feasible, mostly in that the access to actual devices is problematic in these sorts of more open collaborations in order to support development after a certain bootstrap point. OpenMoco was also not able to avoid proprietary drivers in the development of the phone that they ultimately abandoned. Welt is critical of Symbian because the compiler at this stage in the game is still proprietary, although Ryan Paul very quickly in the article points out a correction here that's really a consequence of an expedited release of the kernel sources, that Symbian's overall plan and roadmap still has them trying to get the kernel to compile ultimately for perpetual development and maintenance on into the future under the GCC. Kuhn is a bit more sanguine about these sorts of issues and seems to think that it may be possible with some known starting point now to get to a free and open stack on a phone. And he points to Android actually as a pretty good starting point and mentions the Replicant project, which is constituted exactly to do this, to achieve a free software stack on a phone. The list of proprietary holdouts, though, that Ryan pulls into the article is fairly daunting. It's not just the phone radio itself, which is really kind of the first hurdle to clear, as was the case with the OpenMoco, but today's smartphones have so many more custom chips that, unfortunately, still we don't have specifications for to come up with open source drivers like Bluetooth, GPS, a variety of media codecs for audio and video to execute power efficiently in hardware. Paul kind of generalizes that concern about proprietary tools into a supposition that vendors really aren't concerned with providing end user freedom. They're adopting open source really as a competitive advantage to get to market faster. And this leads to this sort of attitude where shortcuts around would be a more proper open source model ultimately are taken, like using proprietary tools. In the conclusion of the article, Paul kind of reinforces that idea, that theory, by describing this attitude of sort of throwing code over the wall to the community and expecting external maintainers to do the work of supporting free and open source forks with very little ongoing input from the core project itself. He also touches on other constraints. It isn't just the low-level code. Many of these phones are valuable for the third-party applications that can be loaded on them. Almost all of the distribution systems for these are not open. Palm is the only one, after coming under some fire for this, to address this issue in any kind of meaningful way. And we still don't know a lot of the details about this, what some have described as sort of a second-class citizen app store is ultimately going to look like. Ryan Paul also touches on why this is so much of a risk, that many of the activities that traditionally took place on a personal computer, even a portable, a laptop that we might take with us, are slowly migrating onto these increasingly more capable smartphones. And as that trend continues, the risk of having our activities and our capabilities locked up into a proprietary ecosystem is considerable. This is, in some ways, a corollary to what Jonathan Zittrain talks about in his recent book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. I wonder if there are any constructive or positive lessons that we can take away from the personal computer, whether it's possible to duplicate what ultimately made free software possible on that platform. That is, if we could get to a point where there's enough standardization of phone components that you could build a supposed beige phone if you're a power user and capable enough. In articulating that, though, and thinking about that, I'm not so sure that, kind of given the size constraints on these devices and how much of the proprietary hardware design involved in them is actually about how to fit all of these capabilities. And with every passing week, it seems like they're shoehorning more and more into these smartphones, into these very small form factors. And the operators here also, the telcos, are probably another limit that we didn't have to deal with personal computers. You didn't have to, at least originally with dial-up and the like, although with network neutrality, maybe things are starting to get a little more comparable with the carriers wanting to have more control over what you can and can't do with your broadband. It really took the popularity of the iPhone, if you think about it, to even move things forward just a little bit to the stage where we can have a meaningful discussion about an open phone. But there are still limits on, as I said, the applications we can run, and it may be possible that competitive pressure, if we give into a little bit of optimism, may open things up further still. That is, to compete with Android, Palm, and Symbian, someone else may build an even more open phone, take us maybe through market pressures to that free and open stack that Bradley Kuhn would so much like us to be able to have on these basically portable network devices. So how do we put that pressure on the networks, though, is my question, to kind of keep them from constraining the devices, because it's really not enough in my experience to build a free and open device to begin with, but you have to make sure that that carries through all the way until whatever packaged form it's in when it's purchased off the shelf by the end user. I got very excited at seeing this next piece, an article at ReadWriteWeb about what's admittedly still early days for this Salmon protocol. This is an open protocol for aggregating online comments. It's a project that was begun by John Panzer, primarily, I get the sense, through a discussion at RDubDub's real-time summit that they held recently. The name actually refers to the manner in which comments and annotations on a post somewhere or a bit of content actually swim upstream back to that source content. And the project site itself describes the protocol as open, decentralized, abuse-resistant, and user-centric, all qualities, favorable qualities that we should be interested in building into new protocols like this. To take advantage of Salmon, a source would add a Salmon URL in its Atom or RSS feed, and aggregators downstream of that would make note of this. And when a comment then is added to that aggregator, it would utilize that Salmon URL through some mechanism like what they're recommending now is a PubSub hubbub initially to send that back to the source, kind of like a trackback or a pingback. Either by coincidence or design then, focusing in on PubSub hubbub means that you'll get kind of a near real-time character to the conversation that arises out of what this protocol describes. On the receipt, the source that these aggregators have registered an interest in could optionally republish the comment back out. So any other participants, other clients who've registered for that same, essentially, topic under a traditional publisher-subscriber model would get copies of that conversation as well. So that's how it's kind of decentralized and distributed. The source also can moderate and exert filtering for spam and the like before sending things on. That's why it's actually an optional component of the protocol. They're not obligated to send all comments back through, so it would be resistant to spam just flowing immediately. The ReadWriteWeb article compares it to Discus and JSKit's Echo, and it'll probably come initially, once it gets out of this kind of incubation stage, to publishing platforms in a very similar way that these other earlier offerings have. That is, via plugins, so that it's very easy to participate as it was with its predecessors. The fact that it's completely open, though, should make it easier for a wide variety of clients to start participating. I, for one, can easily see Google Reader, which recently adopted PubSub hubbub, adopting this as well, and hence then adding a huge amount of traction to followers coming in after them to adopting this protocol too. It's not sure how or if it will augment the track back or ping back mechanism in any way. It seems to be overlapping in some regards. It would seem like if your comment actually was a post on another publishing system, you might have to either manually add a Salmon URL or maybe building into the publishing platform itself some sort of auto-discovery of that Salmon URL, much like many of them actually can now do for trackbacks and pingbacks. I don't know about you, but I can't remember the last time I actually had to put one in manually to see that mechanism actually work as designed. Right now, there actually is some sample code up at a Google Code project, even though there isn't a spec doc describing this as of yet. It's how rapidly things are developing, but we're promised that one should be coming forth very soon. I want a protocol like this and a wide variety of implementations to choose from, for much the same reason that I'm eager to see how Mozilla's Raindrop evolves. Talked about that recently as well. I want a single site or tool where I can see all the distributed conversations in which I'm participating, no matter where they start or continue across the net. Otherwise, I tend to comment less because the cost of finding those responses in order to continue the conversation just seems to be too high for me to want to continue participating. It just doesn't seem as worthwhile. And I think that tools like these can bring that cost down and hence have, I think, a greater proliferation of very distributed and much more natural conversations. I wrote about, just in the past couple of weeks, an academic project releasing its first sources for an open source voting system. So I was intrigued to see on Wired, among other sources, a reporting around an existing vendor releasing an open source voting system. Wired, in this case, has a lot of the pertinent details and then some, in particular because the vendor in this case is Sequoia, who in the past has been very, very protective of its sources. And I would say approaching half of this article actually details just how protective they've been. At one point, one of the interesting facts to me was that they requested a $20 million bond before actually releasing source to auditors. The article is also quick to clarify with a quote from Sequoia that this actually has nothing to do with the inadvertent source leak that I also talked about recently. The source here is only for a forthcoming optical scan system that they're going to be putting out there, and it actually is apparently part of an effort. The real impetus here is to support a new standard for a common data format developed and recommended by NIST for these sorts of systems. The product in question runs C# on Linux, so it's probably mono, on the actual voting system itself, what you would encounter in the polling place. And there's a Windows-based system, the other part of the overall system, running a Microsoft SQL database for the elections management. And I'm assuming that means that that's the part of the system that's also running the logistics and tabulation. And this is actually pretty consistent with what we learned from that source leak story, that these are the technologies that Sequoia is using. The article is also careful to explain this is not a truly open source system. Sequoia uses the term public source, so the public is not free to modify these sources and then republish or redistribute them as they would be with a traditional open source or free software project, but they are able to gain those sources to review them for themselves. It should open up to a lot of the researchers, make it a lot easier for them to do the kind of auditing that they've basically been doing anyway through a variety of means, through leaked sources and data disks and the like. For this forthcoming product, Sequoia also seems to have amended its messaging. Now it appears to embrace accuracy and security through transparency, despite the very rough history, as I said at the outset, that the article spends quite a bit of time detailing. Ed Felton and other researchers who have grappled with Sequoia and the other vendors seem to be taking the announcement pretty much on face value, crediting Sequoia for embracing openness despite that problematic past. And I actually have a link from Ed Felton's posting on the Freedom to Tinker blog with, he doesn't actually add too much more detail to what is already covered in the Wired article, but I include this because he does point out that the sources in question cover the entire system, not just the machines used to record the votes. It's everything. He also speculates that this is in response to the pressure that researchers have increasingly mounted over the past handful of years. This is a trend that I've been covering with some interest. And so you can go back into the archives to hear my discussion and some of the stories that I've picked out to chart out this increasing pressure that he talks about. They've routinely found flaws in these systems, errors in the implementation, and weaknesses in these closed systems. So they're not provably any more secure by trying to lock things up and protect it. And that they're now active, they're also active open source projects that may be bringing even more pressure to bear. Like I said, I talked about one within the last couple of weeks, releasing their first preliminary sources. There's one more skeptical interpretation of this, and I can't remember who I saw first espouse this, whether it was Mike Masnick at TechDirk or Matt Assay at Open Road. But it's a speculation that this was really motivated in response to ESNS's acquisition of Diebold's e-voting division, that it makes Sequoia, by comparison to that newly resulting Frankensteinian vendor, that much a smaller a slice of the market. That could be, and we've certainly seen open source being used this way to try to discriminate offerings in the market and gain some sort of competitive advantage, whether it's just through paying lip service or realizing some genuine benefit. It does reinforce Felden's view, though, that it is a value of which the buying precincts and public increasingly are aware. So for whatever reason that they got here, this is a big win, and hopefully, as Felden points out, hopefully it's the first of many. The last story I have is news of a startup that has produced the first 100-core processor. This is, according to Wired, this was actually produced by an outfit called Tylera that was originally spun out of MIT just a few years back. Actually, I'm kind of curious if this comes out of work that Doug Patterson was doing there at MIT on building out of FPGAs anyway. Massively many core boxes for research. This is not an FPGA. This actually is a processor with a more traditional die, but with 100 cores on that single processor die. The article actually gives some pretty good background on this challenge to developing such an aggressive number of cores on a single die. Intel's actually working on their own 100-core processor, but it says it still will be another 5 years or so. One advantage that Intel's competitive offering apparently will have is that it will run the x86 instruction set, removing the need to recompile, as you'll need to do with the Tylera processor. The 100-core model joins previous models that Tylera was shipping, 32-core and 64-core. They all appear to use a standard interconnect, though it's not one that I recognize, at least not in use in a desktop and personal system. It's probably one that is more common in high-end servers and appliances. So it's not, it doesn't look like, as with what I suspect is the predecessor of their work, being based on an FPGA, that it requires like a PCI-based interface, PCI Express-based interface, or something odd like that. Sounds like they're targeting being able to slot into a certain class of computers that's already out there and able to take advantage of these pretty cool-sounding CPUs. The company says that they're targeting, in particular, networking, a couple of different applications there, media processing, transcoding, and the like, and cloud apps, actually. And the last, they appear to be suggesting that you could use these many core units to actually stand up many virtual machines, one per every core or couple of cores. Each of these cores actually has a full CPU, the article notes, complete with its own L1 and L2 cache. So it's not a stripped down processing element. It's the full deal, the full shoot and match. And what actually makes these novel is how Tylera has solved has overcome one of the killer issues with many core processors like this, that is the contention around trying to access an external memory bus. Here, they've adopted an architecture from networking, meshing. So instead of each core connecting, trying to contend and connect to a single resource, the memory bus, they all participate in a sort of a mini network and have, as the article notes, kind of a switch bundled with the actual core, and so they can coordinate and pass data along as needed, resulting in far more bandwidth across the entire die than they would have available with a traditional memory bus. This vastly reduces, not surprisingly, the contention for those memory accesses and allows for this amazing and aggressive improvement in scaling, being able to build out to 100 cores on a chip. They are claiming it will run software unmodified. Now, near as I can tell, though, it does at least require a recompile, unlike, as I said in the beginning there, Intel's comparative effort that will not even require that much. Their product materials mention a GCC-based compiler, though, so it's a freely available toolkit, apparently, and an Eclipse-based IDE to go along with it, so trying to keep the barrier to programming these low, that you don't have to do anything special to your code base other than, as I said, recompiling it for that target processor. Part of the reason why I think the recompilation is necessary here is that it does give the compiler a chance to optimize specifically for this very aggressive and unusual chip architecture. So it's a trade-off that you have to recompile, even though you don't have to undertake the same sorts of changes to your sources, like the article notes you might have to do for a GPU. You also don't have to wait 5 years for Intel's offering to see how that's going to stack up to even avoid the necessity of actually having to recompile and giving that compiler a chance to optimize at compile time for the Tylera chip in this case. One last fact that I dug out in searching around is that the Tylera chip actually supports running Linux, of all things. I guess that's not surprising. Linux supports a wide variety of chip architectures, and it would seem like an outfit like this could, with small investment, port the Linux kernel to their chipset as well. So while you're not likely to be able to run proprietary operating systems on this chip per se, unlike the Intel one, you could potentially build a general purpose Linux server on this. And I think that actually dovetails nicely and makes sense with their focus on cloud computing. They talk specifically about not only standing up these virtual machines, when you look at their marketing materials, probably using something like Xen, which would be, I think, well-suited for this, but also standing up a LAMP stack within those VMs. So my hope is that in making a 100-core chip available to researchers in industry, we would also maybe begin to see a bit of acceleration around this challenge of parallel programming. As much as Tylera's positioning this is not requiring any special technique, it is a resource available so that people can increasingly explore to get the most out of these a novel way of trying to get around the limits of Moore's Law. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've talked about before, and I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. I only have one story that I'm following up on, although I have two links to discuss in doing so. The first is the Register's coverage of Lord Mandelson in the UK still pushing for a three strikes, then disconnect rule in that country. This will actually apparently be making its way into the upcoming digital economy bill, this despite some pullback after the Digital Britain report, where they backed off on disconnection and really went for kind of a defanged notice regime. Mandelson is still issuing some pretty strong rhetoric despite opposition from many advocates, NGOs, and private interests alike. He's mostly pushing for this because he feels it's a sort of a protection for industry. And there's maybe a dash or a dollop of some discussion of new business models, but mostly it smacks of protectionism. And at the same stroke, he's trying to enlist ISPs, maybe actually draft them into this push to protect industry. But he's trying to reassure them. So this is a really tortured and odd sort of discussion around this, that they will not bear the sole burden of cost to implementing these policing efforts. The Register explains that what he's proposing is that rights holders, so big content, will actually pay a flat fee to the ISPs per notification, even though there aren't really any details on how large or small that fee might be. So we have no idea how well this proposal, if at all, it will offset the operating costs that the ISPs will incur. And it doesn't sound like it will really alleviate kind of the logistical headache of a notice regime. The other link I saw in relation to this was news of some opposition to this three-strike plan from an unexpected quarter, that is, law enforcers in the UK. Mike Masnick points out their concerns. Actually, it seems like over any kinds of aggressive moves, not just for three strikes, but also against monitoring and throttling under the auspices of network management, their thinking seems to run to this idea that it will encourage greater use of encryption, and this will then make their own monitoring efforts that much more difficult to undertake. I don't particularly welcome this sort of support, not surprisingly. A monitoring encryption arms race isn't a wise idea for any reason. So I don't want to see their predictions come true for their half of fulfilling that idea. But in the case of file sharing, I think there's a better solution anyway, one that would take place in the marketplace and figuring out how to compete with piracy, as many great thinkers have tried to suggest and puzzle out, or to otherwise figure out how to take advantage of the innovations around file sharing so that, again, at the end of the day, creators ultimately can be rewarded and encouraged to continue contributing into our shared culture. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Wednesday night, will be a monologue on social identity, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and WahaDB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike Version 3.0 United States License.